This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. It's been another month of probably too much TV, but thankfully there's been plenty of new entertainment to keep us busy. This month has served up a fresh slate of dramatic TV treats, plus new films and music. And we're here with another episode of The Hit List to talk through it all. Our guests on The Hit List today are Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Brooke Obi, award-winning film critic and author. Brooke, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Emily Vanderwerf. She's critic at large for Vox. Emily, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
So let's start with a show that's been making waves, the fourth season of The Crown on Netflix. We've now reached the stage in Queen Elizabeth's reign that introduces Lady Diana Spencer and the UK's first female prime minister, Margaret Thatcher.
Your Majesty. I think we have enough respect for one another personally to ask ourselves some of the bigger questions, woman to woman. We are the same age after all.
Really?
Just 6 months between us.
Oh? And who is the senior?
I am, ma'am.
Eric, let's get into how The Crown takes on these figures, starting with the two we heard first there, Margaret Thatcher and the Queen. Talk about how the show portrays this relationship.
Yeah, so there was always a sense that Margaret Thatcher and the Queen were at odds, particularly when you get deeper into this latest season of The Crown, and it shows how the Queen was upset that Margaret Thatcher wouldn't support sanctions against the apartheid government in South Africa. And so what we see on the show is that initially the Queen hopes that they will bond over the idea of their two female leaders who have to deal with a lot of sexism and men who believe that they can't do the jobs, even though they're eminently suited for the jobs that they have. But in that very first meeting, Gillian Anderson's Thatcher is shown to be sexist towards women. And indeed, the real-life Thatcher only had one woman, I believe, in her cabinet the whole time that she was prime minister. So there's a friction between the two that starts to emerge as the Queen realizes what Margaret Thatcher really stands for. And there's an implication that Thatcher has an axe to grind against the Queen and the royals because she doesn't believe that people who are born into a station and haven't worked to get to where they are, that they have the grit required to lead the nation. And that's something that some historians have kind of quibbled with, whether or not that was true. But it is definitely known that the two of them had a rift in real life.
Well, this season also digs into the fraught relationship between Princess Diana and Prince Charles. Here's one memorable exchange between Queen Elizabeth and Prince Charles.
It's the marriage. I have done my best, my very best, and I am suffering.
No, you are not suffering. We are all suffering having to put up with this. Let me make something clear. When people look at you and Diana, they see two privileged young people who, through good fortune, have ended up with everything one could dream of in life. No one, not a single breathing living soul anywhere, sees cause for suffering.
They would if they knew.
Knew what? They know that you betray your wife and make no attempt to hide it. They know that thanks to you, she has psychological problems and eats or doesn't eat or whatever it is she does or doesn't do. They know that you are a spoilt, immature man, endlessly complaining, unnecessarily. Married to a spoilt, immature woman, endlessly complaining, unnecessarily. All anyone wants is for the pair of you to pull yourselves together. Stop making spectacles of yourselves. And make this marriage and your enormously privileged positions in life work.
Brooke, there's been a lot of talk about how the show depicts the royals, and especially this relationship. What's been your take?
Well, I think that this season pretty much shows a very great argument for why the British monarchy should be abolished. Honestly, it's very, very well done television. But just to see the lack of support, just to see the emotional kind of abuse that happens and has kind of, we've well documented throughout history, the way that the Windsors will cannibalize their own family members in order to preserve their power and privilege. And, you know, you do have to lose your identity. You do have to shrink yourself in order to fit into the ideas that are all the rules that are laid out as well. And it can be very damaging to lots of people, as we see with what happens to this young, innocent, naive 19-year-old Diana Spencer, who goes into this family, as well as with Charles, even though he was much, much older. But you do see that he has not been able to be his full self as a result of the rules that are laid upon him. And it's you also see a really good explanation for why it was great that Harry and Meghan decided to get out of there and to start a life outside of Kensington Palace. So,
Eric, what's your take on how the show depicts the royal family's dynamics? Because there has been some controversy over the season.
What I wanted to say was some people who keep track of the royals have disputed the way that the family is portrayed, and in particular the way that Prince Charles is portrayed in this season of The Crown. So there is some dispute about whether or not, you know, how much culpability did Diana Spencer actually have in the way that marriage fell apart. You know, how innocent was she? You know, some have contended that she was the first one to stray in that marriage. I mean, you know, that's the thing about this family. They keep their cards so close to their vest in real life that it is hard to know what goes on behind the scenes. And it is tempting to look at a show like The Crown, which purports to take us behind the scenes, and believe that these conversations, which even the creators admit, you know, several scenes are invented. It's tempting to believe that this is what happened. And we don't know for sure that this is what happened. And we're reaching a point where more and more people who are portrayed on the show are alive and have to sort of cope with what the world thinks after they've seen these portrayals. You know, Prince Charles is still alive. They're portraying Prince Andrew and people who are, you know, beyond the Queen and Prince Philip, who are still alive and still out in the world and still having to deal with these portrayals. And I'm not suggesting that the portrayals are completely off base. I was drawn in by this season, and you know, my hunch is that a lot of it is on target. But there are people who've covered the royal family closely who dispute some of the portrayals.
Well, another show that seems to be on everyone's radar right now is The Queen's Gambit. This mini-series on Netflix turns its spotlight on an orphaned female chess prodigy.
Do you have a clock?
No.
We have a clock-sharing system. If your opponent doesn't have one, come back to the desk and we'll loan you one. Play starts in 20 minutes. What's your rating?
I don't have a rating.
Have you ever played in a tournament before?
No.
Are you sure you want to do this?
I'm sure.
We don't have a women's section. I'll put you in beginners.
I'm not a beginner.
Doesn't matter. If you're an unrated player, you go in beginners with the people under 1600.
What's the prize for beginners?
20.
What about the other section?
First prize in the open is 100.
Is it against any rule for me to be in the open?
Not exactly.
Put me in the open.
Emily, what did you think about The Queen's Gambit?
I really enjoyed The Queen's Gambit. Anya Taylor-Joy, who plays the lead character, we just heard her talking there, is one of my favorite actors working right now, and she is just fantastic to watch in this. Her micro expressions, when you just sort of focus on her face in close-up, just tell the whole story, and it's such an involving story, too. It hits all the beats you'd expect of a coming-of-age story or an underdog sports movie, so it's kind of this weird combination of something like, you know, my so-called called life, and then something like Rocky, and like, I don't know how those two tastes work together, but they work together perfectly.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but in a moment, we'll continue the hit list with the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air reunion and a new batch of holiday movies. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Headspace. Life can be stressful, but 2020 has challenged even the most difficult times of life. You need stress relief that goes beyond quick fixes. That's Headspace. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations in an easy-to-use app. Overwhelmed? Headspace has a 3-minute SOS meditation for you. Go to headspace.com/1A for a free month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Since the 1980s, hip-hop and America's prisons have grown side by side.
And we're going to investigate this connection to see how it lifts us up and holds us down.
Hip-hop is talking about what we live, trying to live the American dream, failing at the American dream.
I'm Sydney Madden.
I'm Rodney Carmichael. Listen now to the Louder Than a Riot podcast from NPR Music,
where we trace the collision of rhyme and punishment in America.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing the biggest moments in pop culture this month with Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR, Brooke Obi, award-winning film critic and author, and Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large for Vox. Walter tweets that they're watching Lucifer, Scandal, Power, and Peaky Blinders, all shows that I had planned to watch long ago but was never home long enough to do so until now. Hashtag stay at home. And John tweets, I don't know if an internet show counts. It does, but I've been making it through with Critical Role. Not familiar with that one, but I will have to look it up. Let's turn to something else new this month. HBO adapted Ta-Nehisi Coates' acclaimed 2015 book, Between the World and Me, and it's written as a letter to his son. Here's the film open with actor Joe Morton.
This is the week that you learned that the killers of Michael Brown would never be punished. You were young and still believed. You stayed up until 11 p.m. that night waiting for an announcement of an indictment. And when instead it was announced that there was none, you said, I got to go. And you went into your room and I heard you crying. I came in 5 minutes after and I did not hug you. I did not comfort you. I thought it would be wrong to comfort you. I did not tell you that it would be okay because I never have believed that it would be okay. What I told you is what your grandparents tried to tell me, that this is your country.
Eric, talk about the way this is adapted for the screen.
Sure. I was lucky enough to moderate a panel with the director, Camila Forbes, and Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote the book that inspired this film and also served as executive producer for the film. And, you know, the film is sort of created as this sort of tone poem in a way. It is a collection of monologues taken from the text of the book, read by actors like Joe Morton, who are just so skilled at finding new meanings and new ways of conveying the ideas that Ta-Nehisi so elegantly portrayed in the book. And then they're also married with a host of different techniques to bring you through different moods. So they filmed a monologue in one of the courtyards at Howard University, because Howard University looms as a big focal point in the book and the film, as a place where Black excellence is sort of protected and incubated, and then a place where it draws power from all the different kinds of Black folks who gather there. And so seeing a monologue filmed in that empty courtyard says something about COVID, says something about where we are today, says something about the importance of the school. And then there's animation that shows young Black kids playing and conveying some of the joy of Black culture. And then there's archival footage of people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Angela Davis speaking out alongside Ta-Nehisi's lines, asking pointed questions about why we are taught in schools about some civil rights leaders who are nonviolent and we're not taught about others who are more revolutionary. And so it all comes together to create this amazing statement about the dangers and the beauty of being a Black person in America. And and how the system tries to take you apart and eliminate your body in one moment, but how you can find community and you can find excellence and you can find beauty in your culture in another. It is just an amazing piece of work.
Well, let's change gears a bit and talk about the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air reunion that's been airing on HBO Max. The headline moment was when Janet Hubert, who played the original Aunt Viv, was given a chance to confront Will Smith publicly over their feud.
When I left the show, I had this new baby and no one. Family disowned me. Hollywood disowned me. My family said, you've ruined our name. And I wasn't unprofessional on the set. I just stopped talking to everybody because I didn't know who to trust because I had been banished. And they said it was you who banished me. Because you were Will. You were a kid. It was hard.
Brooke, can you give us a little more context on this 30-year-long feud and what this moment really meant?
Yes. So I think for all of us fans of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, the most glaring and obvious issue with this revolutionary show that addressed so many issues that we face in our community and told so many of our great stories and was so funny. The glaring issue was that midway through the 6-season run, they replaced the dark-skinned Aunt Viv with what became known as the light-skinned Aunt Viv. And so to understand, we've seen kind of the tabloid headlines over the years with Alfonso Ribeiro and Janet Hubert going back and forth about whose fault it was and who did what to whom. But so there was never really any clarity except for the fact that we knew that Janet basically disappeared. This was this talented, amazing Black woman who could dance, she could sing, she was a classically trained actress. I mean, she had it everything. She had it all. And then she lost it. And her career never recovered. And we never really knew why. So to be able to sit there and see her sharing her truth in this reunion and to not receive any pushback, just to be able to talk, I thought that was really powerful. Even though she did end up apologizing before Will apologized, you know, at least she did get her apology and she did get her moment. But I think 27 years is entirely too long to have to wait for something like that. We've all been impacted by the loss of Janet. I'm not seeing her on our screens, not just you know, as fans, but also when you call, like Janet was explaining, when you call a dark-skinned Black woman difficult, that doesn't just impact Janet. That means that other dark-skinned Black actresses who were trying to work in this industry were also impacted, and also could have, you know, received, well, you know, we know what kind of people and behavior that these kinds of actresses are. So let's just avoid all of that. We've seen colorism happen throughout the industry, you know, beyond these past 27 years, but definitely during this time as well, and continuing on now, we see that happening. And so, you know, I do think that while that was a beautiful moment and Janet does seem to feel as if she has received everything that she needs to receive from this moment and from this apology, I do think that there are more reparations that need to be paid for all of the losses that we've had and the Black women that we'll never know that we lost because of stereotypes like this.
Well, I want to turn to holiday movies because it is November, which means holiday movies are in full force. Emily, one of the holiday movies you wanted to bring up is Happiest Season. It's a new Christmas rom-com from Hulu that centers around a coming out story. Tell us about the movie and why it came up as one of your recommendations this month.
You know, if you are looking for a movie that breaks the Christmas movie format even more than, you know, having a lesbian couple at its center, this is maybe not the one. It is a very traditional Christmas rom-com in almost every way, but at the center are Kristen Stewart and Mackenzie Davis, who have fantastic chemistry. And it is one of those stories that, like, we don't have a ton of stories about queer people at Christmas time. And so it's really lovely to see this telling that story. And I do, you know, it's full of great performers. the characters who aren't the two central ones don't get the best of storylines, but it is like fun to see like Mary Steenburgen come in and, you know, just deliver a few lines in a Southern accent and have a great time. But yeah, the central story is really the reason to watch here. And those two actors are fantastic together.
Now, you also have a recommendation for an 8-episode holiday romantic comedy series on Netflix. It's actually based on some young adult books.
Yeah. It's called Dash and Lily. It's about two teenagers who sort of who start passing around this notebook that they trade dares with each other in. And this one's actually, I think, really well done for what it is. It's a YA romance set around Christmas. So if any of those three things turned you off, maybe don't watch. But if that sounds great to you, I think you're really going to like this. It's, you know, it has its issues. I think that the show has this like weird class politics where the two main characters sort of treat all the service industry workers they run into like, you know, not the greatest, but it's really lovely and winning. And again, this is one of those things where the chemistry between the two leads is so potent that it's kind of worth watching for that.
Eric, really briefly, do you have any new holiday movies you're enjoying this year, or maybe something you want to revisit during the holidays?
I'm not a real holiday movie person. So my favorite holiday movies are really odd. So the first one is Die Hard, which, you know, there's a whole debate about whether or not it's even a Christmas movie. I am not entertaining that debate at all. It is a Christmas movie, and I do watch it at Christmas, and that's the end of it. And then also The Grinch with Jim Carrey, which a lot of people don't like, but it has become a family tradition in my home. Me and my kids sit down and watch it every year.
I'm a fan of Elf around Christmas. We're talking about the latest in pop culture this month with Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR, Brooke Obie, award-winning film critic and author, and Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large for Vox. And we're hearing some music from Netflix's Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, which is a magical story about a toy maker. I watched it over the weekend. I can't recommend it highly enough. We'll talk about it a bit more after the break. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
Lauren Coe of Loco Kitchen went from pie-zaster.
It looked like a crime scene. All the berry juices were everywhere.
To pie master. She'll share tips based on years of baking delicious pies that are stunning works of art, too. Listen and subscribe to NPR's Life Kit.
Now let's get back to the hit list, our pop culture roundup with Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR, Brooke Obie, award-winning film critic and author, and Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large for Vox. Brooke, what did you think of Jingle Jangle?
I thought Jingle Jangle was very sweet. I was very excited for my niece and nephew to watch it because it's just something that we'd never get to see. I mean, it's black fantasy and Christmas and just so many wonderful things, but also magic. You know, there are math geniuses. There are two little black girls who are math geniuses, and there's Forrest Whitaker, there's Felicia Rashad, there's Anikanani Rose. It's a musical. I mean, it just feels like it has all of those things that we love about this season in a way, in a story that we've never seen before. So I thought it was very inventive and very cute. I'm overlooking some of the plot holes that exist.
Just overlook them.
It's just cute. Yeah,
just overlook
them. It's cute, and my niece and nephew love it, so I'm happy.
Well, and if you need a reminder that Anikanani Rose can sing her whole entire face off, just wait till like the back third of the film. She has this amazing number, and she's just such an incredible vocalist. I loved it. It's a great family watch. Well, we got a whole new slate of fall TV this month, and some decided to include the pandemic in their storyline or have actors wear face masks on scene. A lot of you are bringing up This Is Us as a show you're watching, and this is one of the shows grappling with the pandemic. Eric, how are you seeing shows take on COVID-19?
Well, it's been interesting. That is a choice that every showrunner had to make as the lockdown shut down production of television over the summer. But producers and writers were still meeting and trying to figure out what they were going to do once production resumed. And now we're learning, you know, network TV shows in particular are coming back to new episodes, you know, this past week and the week before, and we'll see more come back in the first week of December. So you have some shows, particularly the medical shows and the first responder shows. Of course, they're going to have to deal with it. So The Good Doctor is dealing with COVID. You know, Chicago Med and Chicago Fire and places like that have all of their doctors and first responders, emergency people dealing with COVID. There was a controversy with an ABC show called Big Sky, which was created by David E. Kelley, who you may know from, remember from L.A. Law and The Practice and shows like that. And he has a show that involves these two women who run a private detective agency. And it's set during the time of COVID. They show during the show that some people are wearing masks, but there are scenes set in a restaurant and set in a bar where most people aren't wearing masks. And it's really kind of weird. And they decided to set it during the time of COVID, but have a bunch of characters who aren't really sort of obeying any of the guidance that you have from health authorities about how you're supposed to be living during this time. And I think that's the problem that some of these shows are going to run into. If you set it during the time of COVID, you are committing your characters to conducting themselves in a certain way, and you're committing yourself to trying to portray the world in a certain way, where there's a whole other level of behavior that you have to sort of portray. And I think a lot of these shows are going to have trouble being consistent. Mm-hmm. You know?
Emily, how are we seeing reality shows dealing with the pandemic?
You know, reality shows actually have an easier time sort of constructing a bubble around their production. Not every reality show, but some of the ones that people know best. For instance, something like The Bachelor is really able to construct, in essence, a bubble where people can't leave and sort of stay in the same place. And that way they can all ensure that they're staying COVID-free. Another show that's done a good job of that is the ABC series Shark Tank, which constructed its own bubble in Las Vegas. I mean, a lot of this is network publicists saying this, so we don't know how non-permeable those bubbles are, but we haven't heard about an outbreak in those series either, where there have been outbreaks on other scripted series where there isn't a bubble. So there is some, you know, idea that reality shows maybe have an easier time of this, even if, you know, something like something a little bit more wide-ranging like The Amazing Race would not be able to be produced in this environment.
Right. B tweets, my daughter and I have recently discovered Parenthood on Hulu and are completely invested, surprisingly well-written with good acting. And let's see, one listener tweets, I actually watched Jingle Jangle and it was an excellent movie with an excellent cast. I can't get the image of Forest Whitaker dancing out of my head, though. It was hilarious. Don't clown Forest Whitaker. We love Forest Whitaker. Let's pivot to some new music that came out this month. Megan Thee Stallion dropped her new album, Good News, and here's one of the tracks, Body, which she performed at the AMAs this week. And if the beat live, you know Lil Juke made it. Body, yaddy, 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 yaddy. Body, yaddy, 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 yaddy. Body crazy, curvy, wavy beat. Yeah, Lil Wayne. Body crazy, curvy, wavy beat. Lil Wayne. Body, yaddy, yaddy, yaddy. Okay, Brooke, 2020 has been a significant year for Megan Thee Stallion. She's coming off the wild success of WAP with Cardi B. How does this album measure up for you?
I think this album is fun. It's very in Megan's lane. You know, I think the good news is that Megan can do even better than this on her next album. I mean, this is her debut album, so there's been a lot of anticipation for it. She's already hit so many milestones without even having an album. So, you know, it's only up from here. But I do think, you know, it's trending right now, number one on iTunes for that single as well as the album itself. She's in a good position. And, you know, she's just so lyrically talented. But it's fun. There are a lot of really fun songs on the album. It's very enjoyable, and I can't wait for her, you know, to go deeper in her next album.
Chris tweets, Parks and Recreation is a standard fallback for comedic relief with a strong sense of heart and gratitude. Emily, are you turning to any comfort shows these days?
Yeah, you know, this is a time when I'm watching more old TV than I'm watching new TV. That was kind of true for me already. Some of these newer shows I find hard to take, but I've been watching a lot of Star Trek Deep Space Nine recently. Yeah. It's you know, obviously a show that's from the 90s, and there are some cheesy production values and all of that, but it's a really wonderful portrayal of, you know, what the future could look like that sort of leaves me optimistic that we might get out of this right now.
I've been thinking about turning back to DS9. I'm watching the more recent iteration of Star Trek on CBS, but I've been thinking I need to revisit that series, and this is another plug for that. Eric, what about for you? Any comfort shows you're turning to right now?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the more recent. I'm actually watching that as well. I'm watching Star Trek Discovery, and because I'm a TV critic, you know, I get episodes early, so I'm two episodes ahead of the general public and watching that show. But I'm enjoying watching their new vision of the Federation and all of that. I also, with my 16-year-old son, have been rewatching The Closer, this police drama that Kira Sedgwick starred in. Now, the thing that's weird about it is that there are a lot of elements of the show that are quote unquote copaganda. They are they're designed to paper over the excesses of the cops who are pursuing criminals. You see them disregarding people's rights, convincing people to disregard their Miranda rights. They do all kinds of things that are questionable on the show. But my son and I watch it so that we can critique the show, and we're always looking at each other. I can't believe they did that. You know, that's what happens when you're, I think, a TV critic and you've raised a kid. We're both critiquing the thing while we're watching it, and also experiencing the nostalgia of watching a show that we still somehow like, even though it's incredibly flawed. So there you go.
Brooke, any nostalgic views for you these days?
You know what? I just started watching again Schitt's Creek. It's just, I tried to watch it before the pandemic, and I couldn't get into it. But after all the hype, winning all the Emmys and all of that, I thought, you know, why not give it a try? And now being locked down with my family in a situation that I can't really control because of this pandemic, it really has brought that show into a new context for me. And it's just so funny, and it's just so lovely and sweet. And it's the kind of show that is just really powerful in that it created this world where homophobia essentially doesn't exist, that there's a gay couple that is just beautiful and lovely, and they have the normal ups and downs, but they don't face any criticism from the outside world. And I just thought, if you could write a show, any show, and have it be something this powerful, why wouldn't you do it? I think it's such a great example for us of what we can, of the power of television and what we can do if we allow ourselves to imagine the kind of worlds that we want to see and put those on TV instead of, you know, the hyper realistic shows that we have, whether it's with COVID or police brutality or all these. Why not create the show that shows us who we could be?
Really quickly before we wrap up, Eric, any last suggestions for folks, things they should watch over the long weekend?
Wow. There's a great series of films called Small Acts that's on Amazon. Steve McQueen, the director of 12 Years a Slave, curated and was involved with the production of these. The first of those films went up on Amazon on Friday. And it's about a restaurant that caters to West Indian immigrants in Britain, and how the police tried to shut it down with multiple raids, and how protests led by the Black Panthers led to a court case that allowed them to push back against the racism in late 1960s Britain against Black immigrants. It's a really great film and a great series of films that people should check out.
That's Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR, Brooke Obie, award-winning film critic and author, and Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large for Vox. Thanks to you all. Today's producers were Michelle Harvin and Hector Arzade. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. Let's talk more tomorrow. This is 1A.